Welcome to the Dungeon Plunger Podcast. My name is Jason Weeb, and this is the show in which I, a real-life janitor and dungeon master, teaches you how to plunge in and run a better Dungeons & Dragons game. Without further ado, let's plunge into this week's episode. Welcome, Dungeon Plunger Union members. I have my plus one plunger, my coffee-flavored holy water, and I have a very special union member with us today to help plunge the dungeon and flush evil down the drain. Today we have a legend on the show, the designer of some of the most famous adventure modules in D&D, including Dwellers of the Forbidden City, the Isle of Dread, and the creator of the AD&D 2nd edition of Dungeons & Dragons. Welcome, David Zeb Cook, to the show.
Hey there.
So, David, I wanted to, I guess I should say Zeb. That's, you started the hobby
as a... Say whatever you want, as long as it's not, you know, toad face.
All right. Keep that in mind. As long as it's not late for dinner. You started the hobby as a war gamer in the University of Iowa. Why do you think that so many war gamers were gravitated towards this fledgling new hobby of Dungeons & Dragons?
Well, because in some ways, war gaming was the really only option you had, you know, for unless you wanted to play Monopoly or something like that. And so, you know, if you wanted to get into something that was more intense and more kind of like I am the guy in the moment kind of thing, then you did wargaming, because then, you know, you were like, you could imagine I am the general or whatever. And so it wasn't necessarily that there were like, oh my god, we lured over tons of diehard wargamers, or it was like we lured over tons of guys who really liked all kinds of games. And, you know, war games were the one that, you know, you could get together with groups and group and you could play for one, you know, a couple hours and have a good time. And then, you know, Dungeons & Dragons showed up, and it's like the war gaming club I was in, you know, we had theater majors. We had, you know, I was an English major. We had, you know, law guys who were studying law. We had guys who were in the ROTC. We had all this, right? And, you know, some of them were like, oh, look, hey, this game over here, it's got all this like wacky story and fantasy stuff. And you know, it's like, wow. And it resonated because it built clearly off of war game elements that we all knew. And at the same time, like, did wholly new things that were like, yeah, this is cool. And so it was a very easy shift for a lot of people to kind of go over and start playing that.
That makes sense. I heard that from a friend of mine that apparently you run some sort of like a kaiju mass miniatures battle kind of monstrosity.
Well, I am still a diehard miniatures war gamer guy. I don't play board war games much anymore, but I do like, you know, pushing around little. You know, toy soldiers and that sort of stuff. But I'm kind of an idiot. so it's like, you know, we did when we got to TSR, there were a number of us who all, you know, were perfectly familiar with like miniature wargaming and all this sort of stuff. It wasn't like this divide that you kind of see today where it's like, oh, I play role-playing games and I don't play anything else. We played everything, right? And, you know, so we played a lot of miniatures, historical, all this stuff. But after a while, we noticed that, like, you know, these fantasy company, you know, miniatures producers were putting out all sorts of miniatures that, you know, didn't match up with anything. It's like, oh, look, this was a toad guy on a giant chameleon. It's a really cool miniature, but what the hell? You know, what are we going to do with it? Right? So we created this thing called the interplanar miniatures battles, where basically one person would act as kind of the referee and everybody else would, you know, bring whatever painted miniatures they wanted. It didn't, you know, and because it was an excuse to use all these weird miniatures, they didn't match up with anything. And they would write up stats for them, and then we would have a big, you know, and the referee guy would kind of review them all and, you know, adjust some to kind of make some hope of balance. And originally it was all just pretty much everybody was using kind of D&D rules and this sort of stuff. And we'd do these battles, and it was all like, oh, this guy's like, that's clearly a really powerful wizard guy. And other side, until I think it was Errol Otis had painted up a bunch of chameleon. He'd gotten a hold of some miniature chameleons, right? Now, why, you know, some miniature companies decided to make, and they had riders on them, right? Why would we have somebody make miniature chameleons with riders on them? And they were in battle, and they came up on something. And I think it was Harold Johnson who was often the victim of these kinds of things. But he had his like powerful 20th level wizard or whatever up there. And Errol said, okay, well, my chameleon attacks, right? Okay. And, you know, roll the dice. And he rolls the dice. And then he says, oh, and yeah, and he makes his, and he attacks with his tongue. And mind you, this was like, you know, in miniatures rules, this was like when Harold's guy was still like 6 or 7 inches away from him, right? And the description was, yeah, his tongue shoots out, whaps him. Oh, he got like a 20 or something of this, hits him and swallows him whole. and pretty much, you know, killed this wizard instantly, right? and it was like, you know, people are like, what? And so it's like, oh yeah, that's what my guy can do, and it's all been approved. And at that point, kind of the shutters went off our eyes, or the lights went on or whatever, right? And realized like, holy crap, we don't have to just stick by standard AD&D rules. We can make up anything, as long as it's within the kind of whatever guidelines of balance that D&D had, the DM had. And at that point, the interplanar battles just went crazier and crazier. We had somebody fielded, I think it was, I'm not sure if it was Evan Robinson or Paul Ritchie, fielded a batch of awful green things. They played the awful green things game, and they had eggs, and they had the little, you know, the hatchling guys, and they have the running monster ones and all the other stuff, basically it was, well, when you attacked them, you didn't know what your attack did. And then like in awful green things, you would draw a chit to say kind of like, was it ineffective? Was it quite doubly effective? Did it cause them to explode and leave eggs behind, or all these sorts of things, right? And so, you know, suddenly, you know, strange things. I had a group of little anime figures that I had found, these plastic anime figures. And these were like, you know, 135 or something. They were big things. And painted those up, and decided that they just worked by paper, scissors, rock. And then if you attack them, you played a round of paper, scissors, rock. And I wrote that I got to win ties. And it was great. And then one of our other guys, who was a math guy, kind of later on figured out, like, wait a minute, that gave you a huge advantage. So we started doing all this kind of crazy stuff. So then years and years later, at GaryCon, where they do the kind of legends of role-playing thing, I got talked into basically kind of running a simplified version of an interplanar, which is, because I had to provide everything, you know, you can't ask people to bring stuff and all that stuff. And so I had a bunch of giant Godzilla plastic toys. I had some Russian infantry army men. I had a bunch of cowboys I'd painted up. I had some standard D&D guys. I can't remember what all else it was. And put them all out on the table, and you know, they all kind of worked by their own completely different rules. But, you know, like the cowboys used Boot Hill rules. And so So, you know, when they did damage, they would just like roll, look, that's a mortal wound, and it was a headshot. You know, that guy's dead, whatever. Because they could have killed Godzilla that way, but they didn't. But anyway, and then, just let people kind of experience a little bit of this lunacy that we used to do. We were gamers. We would play anything.
That's incredible. That is such an incredible story. How does that work when you combine all those different rule sets together? Like,
often it doesn't work.
I mean, there must have been like actual fights where people.
There were often some kind of like, you know, poutiness and all this stuff, but you know, we all knew kind of what we were getting to, that these things are probably going to be badly unbalanced somewhere, but it wasn't about like, I'm going to be the guy who wins. It was about you know, being around a table and just seeing what kind of crazy chaos we could do. Tom Mulvey was one of the first ones to introduce the idea that, you know, you could have guys that operated by a completely different set of rules, because he put out a whole bunch of Boot Hill guys, and Harold Johnson, once again, went up against one of his guys and promptly got his high level wizard guy got shot in the head for a mortal wound and killed him instantly. And John Pickens was evil. You know, John Pickens was he was a really nice guy, and you would not believe he had such a cunning, evil mind to him. But he put out he found legitimate AD&D monsters, or, you know, these things called the Gibberlings, and they all had one hit point. And the way we were doing the balancing was you got to do like 1,000 hit points worth of stuff. So, you know, if you had like, you know, some really high level guys, they could eat that up. All his guys, so he had 1,000 of these things technically, but because he couldn't put 1,000 on the table at a time, he basically said, well, they're all off in this other dimension. And, you know, only so many of them can be basically, you know, in this plane at this time. And so, you know, there'd be like 20 or 30 of these things would come running out, right? And you'd hit them with a fireball. Well, they'd all die instantly. Didn't matter. Save didn't matter, right? But there were still then 20 or 30 would show up the next round. And it was like, he had 1,000 of these things. Yeah, it broke things horribly, but it was pretty funny.
Yeah, it sounds awesome. So when did you go to TSR, like take the job at TSR? Was that like around 79-ish, 80?
Yeah, I started in 79. Actually, I think I started on June 6th of all dates. I basically had been playing D&D since about 74 or so, 75, something like that. And they had run an ad in like 78 looking for designers, and, you know, I applied and amazingly enough managed to get hired. And I started in 79. It was the summer where they released the Dungeon Master's Guide. It was the last of the AD&D books. And got to watch the kind of throngs at Kenosha, you know, waiting to get their books, and realized, holy crap, this is like a lot of people playing this game.
So this was like when you got the job, like you before you had been given the job, or this was like was that the impetus to say, hey, this is a like I could actually make a living doing this if I applied for this job?
Well, I don't know if I didn't know if I could make a living at it at all, but nobody knew if we could make a living, because basically the idea of hiring people to be designers didn't really exist. And I was a teacher in Nebraska, and it was like, I think I would rather be doing this. My wife, approved. We actually took a paid cut. So at that point, I'm not sure it was like, wow, I'm going to make a living at this. But it was like, I'm going to be going doing something that, you know, was much more satisfying for me than being an English teacher, which was, you know, for all the noble and valiant things about being an English teacher, I was not the person set out to do that, be that person.
So would you say to those kind of people who are aspiring to be to follow their passion, their artistic desires, or whatever it is the moral, like, just go out and do it and then see what happens?
I part of me says, yeah, that's a great idea. And the other part of me says, especially these days, is go find a job you can make money at. Do that job and then do this passion thing. If you're really serious about doing the passion, do it on the side, because trying to make a living as a full-time designer is hard. And it's especially hard if you're trying to do it just from the get-go. You know, just, you know, do it as a side job, make, you know, make the contacts, deliver the products, you know, deliver products on time, you know, learn how to do the job, learn how to do it. And gradually, you know, if you're serious and you're, you know, I won't say good enough, because a lot of times it's a matter of if you deliver, and, you know, doesn't even have to be astounding work, but if you deliver something, right, that's going to get you more work. And if you get more work and gradually, you know, build that reputation and play lots of different games, spend time, you know, don't just play role-playing games, play other games too, and really get out there and kind of, like, you know, educate yourself on what can I do? What's the dumbest idea I can do and make it work?
I like that attitude.
But these days I would advise that's probably a much wiser way to do stuff. And it may never become your full-time job, but it'll become a part of your life that was, for you, very satisfying, and, you know, that sort of stuff.
Your wife plays with you, Helen.
Oh yeah.
In Bill's game, but she was playing way before that.
I taught her how to play D&D as well. Kind of a strange, you know, courtship ritual. But I taught her how to play D&D, and then I married her. But so she's always enjoyed it. And for a long time, I was her only DM, because we lived in places where we couldn't find people. And so I would run solo games for her. But and then for quite a while, I worked in gaming industry. And especially, you know, towards the end of the time, yeah, TSR, it was great. There were lots of people. There were always people you could find a game. Then we went off to, like, do other video games and stuff. It became much harder. And it was also, like, I was kind of, you know, get very burned out at that point on doing a lot of role-playing stuff. And so, you know, for a while, we mostly, you know, we played video games and that sort of stuff. And then we ran into Bill and we moved out to the West Coast. And yeah, he invited us to play a game, and it was like, oh yeah, now it's like a thing we both look forward to.
Nice. So when you went to go to work at TSR, was Gary still there at the time?
Oh yeah, he hired me.
Yeah. Yeah. So what was that like working with Gary? And
well, it was interesting, because he hired us in part because he was too busy to do this kind of work. He was around, like, now trying to run a company and stuff. So everybody imagines that we spent, you know, hand and fist time with Gary plotting over stuff. And no, mostly we were off in our own part doing things, and Gary was off running a company and reviewing and giving, you know, sending his notes and feedback and stuff. And so, you know, although, you know, I did definitely spend time with him and do stuff, it wasn't like he was there every day giving us direction. It was more like, you know, every few weeks or a couple of months he would show up, you know, or we would get together and talk about stuff, or you'd get, and, you know, you'd get memos saying that, like, what you did was crap, or, you know, that sort of, or you get memos saying how we all had to now do use a time clock, you know, and that sort of thing. Yeah. So, you know, so it was kind of directly indirect or indirectly direct kind of stuff. But, you know, I got to spend time with him, and I, you know, he was a, he was a smart guy. He was very personable. And But at the same time, he wasn't in the trenches doing stuff quite as much as we were at that stage. And so we developed a different perspective on things at times.
Yeah, I could see that. What was like a day, like a typical day, like working at TSR back in the, during that time?
Oh, the typical day would be you'd show up around 9 or 10 in the morning, and we had offices up on the third floor of this rundown building in Lake Geneva that eventually, after we left, did get condemned. somebody fixed it up though, you know, but you had like, oh, we needed to write this adventure, and you know, you've got, you know, 6 weeks to do it in or something like that. And so, you know, you just sit down and you'd like sit, you know, at that point we were working on, you know, manual typewriters or electric typewriters. But, and mind you, if you had the Selectric that could actually let you then backspace and correct your errors, that was like you were doing great. And then, you know, after a couple of years, we moved into, we were working on Burroughs terminals, which were just like, you know, you got the little amber blue, the amber green screen text and stuff. We were using some kind of programmer's line editor to write stuff. So if you needed to go back and make a change, you had to enter the line number in and then go up and find it and change it. All this sort of stuff, right? And that was an improvement over the other stuff. and then eventually, you know, they started, you know, I think I wound up buying a laptop and using WordPerfect and, you know, writing in WordPerfect, because that was so much better than the line editor. But I had to use my own laptop because, you know, it's like, so yeah, it was, but basically you spent your days writing. We would meet at lunch. We would usually go someplace at lunch or gather together at lunch and talk about stuff. If you wanted to test something, you could try to organize a play test in the office, but that was kind of hard because everybody else had schedules. So you would maybe organize play tests after work, or you would resort to the method of just finding somebody who had a little time, and you'd sit down with them and say, like, okay, this is the situation. You come into this room, you see these things, this thing. What do you do? Right? You're a standard kind of adventuring party. What are you going to do? And then you would go, they'd tell you like, oh, I hadn't thought about that. I got to go cover that kind of thing. Or, you know, and you would literally, and after you did this enough, it becomes kind of part of your DNA. And you would be able to say, hey, yeah, I know that if I put them in this situation, that I've got to make sure I cover this. And this is something they're going to do. And I'm going to give the referee some notes about, like, if they go off script, you know, here's how to get them back. But mostly it was writing, or then reviewing other people's manuscripts and you know, making notes on them, that sort of thing. And then revising and fixing stuff.
So in 1981, Dwellers of the Forbidden City comes out. this is apparently the reason, one of the things that you had to do to get hired was you had presented this, is that right?
When I applied, they sent over basically their test, which had like 20 some questions, which if you read Dragon magazine carefully and you had knew enough history and stuff, you could get through that, right? And it included everything from like identifying obscure polearms to, yes, there were questions about obscure polearms. And a few other things like that, but also a lot of it was like, you know, what can this class do, or if you're in this situation, you know, what's the appropriate amount you would charge for a magic item, that sort of thing. There was a lot of stuff, but you also, and they wanted a writing sample, and so they wanted like a 6 to 10 page writing sample, so. I had this adventure that I had done in college, and so I pulled up some maps from that and, you know, filled it out, created, I think, one monster, which probably, I think it was, I'm not sure if it was, I think it was the Yuan Ti at that point. It might have been the Tassloy. And basically it was, and it was just a little you know, kind of like Lost City dungeon crawl kind of a thing. And sent that off, and apparently they liked that. Okay. And then when Dwellers of the Forbidden City said, okay, let's put this on the schedule, it was like, you know, take the thing that you, you know, so like, okay, well, I'll take the thing that I did as a resume and basically, you know, expand it, fill it out, put in, and basically all that had been is just like a little, you know, 10-room dungeon crawl or something like that. So I expanded all that, added in the whole wilderness thing, created the city, you know, added a bunch more monsters, but the Yuan Ti were definitely kind of like the big focus of it. And, you know, and I was going for a very kind of a Conan-esque, you know, jungle adventure kind of a thing. And, and then put that out. And so, yeah, so my brief resume thing got expanded into a full adventure.
Did you expect that 45 years later that this would be considered to be a masterpiece among D&D modules?
I think that might be overstating its quality, but...
Well, I mean, I would argue against that just because, first of all, it introduced a whole bunch of iconic monsters. I mean, you got the Aboleth, you got the Rungle Men.
I'm very happy with Yuan-Ti. Yuan-Ti were always very cool. They were like, you know, creepy good monsters you could have fun with.
But eventually it gets used as part of the Tomb of Annihilation, like reworked and put into the Tomb of Annihilation D&D 5th edition campaign.
Oh, I haven't even been aware of that.
Oh, really? Wow, that's incredible. So they basically use the map. Like, I mean, the map has been updated to the like style of 5th edition
hopefully
D&D.
It's a better map, yeah. I would hope.
But it's the Lost City of Omu. And that's basically where Acerak has his dungeon, and you have to go and explore the city, and the Yuan-Ti are there, and they're doing their thing, and yeah, that's incredible. I had no idea. I thought for sure that you would have been like...
The folks who are working on 5e are doing their thing, and they don't I'm assuming they don't have time, and they certainly, don't feel like it's, and it's really not necessary for them to reach out to all the people that they've done, because, you know, this is a shared world, right? When I was working on stuff that other people did, I didn't necessarily reach out to them. It's like, hey, I'm going to do this. Might have if they were in office and that sort of thing, but it's a shared world. They take the things that they like from that, existed and figure out how to like give them new life. So
I think in Dungeon Magazine, it's, I don't know which issue, but they did like the top 30 D&D adventures, and I'm like 99% sure that this one is up in there.
I think I had two or three in there, maybe three. Yeah.
So talking about Isle of Dread then, which is also like an icon,
because it went into every extra box.
So this is the centerpiece for the Savage Tide adventure path that Paizo made for the Dungeon Magazine. So you were aware of that?
Nope.
Really? Wow.
No, I went off to do video games. And okay. Basically, it's impossible to try and keep up on it. And also to worry about it is a little bit, feels a little bit like vanity, and I don't think I wanted.
That's fair.
You know, didn't know if I really wanted to go. You know, it's interesting to find out the way, you know, I like to hear what people do with the stuff I did. And you know, occasionally I might find that, oh, I wouldn't have done that, and I try to bridle my irritation and just let it go. You know, because it's somebody else's eyes on it at that.
You also worked on the expert book.
Oh, yeah.
For BX. I was reading in an interview in 2009 that you did with James Malashevsky of the Grenardia blog.
Okay.
And I don't know if I misunderstood, but basically it said that you guys were trying to make a transition with BX to like AD&D, but apparently there was some sort of like legal issue that was preventing you from like connecting the two so that you could start with those sets and then move on to AD&D.
Well, we thought about that. We certainly thought that in basic, that when we started, when Tom was starting working basic, that would make the most sense. But we got told that essentially they wanted this to be a separate line.
Okay.
They didn't really explicitly say, and we don't ever want this to connect to D&D or AD&D, or, but that this was a separate line, so that, because the view in that time, the view was that we were explained to us, and mind you, there may have been secret ulterior motives we don't know about, was that AD&D was a more complex game.
Okay.
And what they wanted is, they wanted a line that would appeal to, you know, as they refer to it, as 10-year-olds and up, right? They wanted to get the 10-year-olds and the you know, 12 and you know whatever year olds and playing, and they wanted to give them a full line, because some people, you know, that's all the further they want to go. But they also knew that probably a bunch of those 10 and 12 year olds would go off and find AD&D, and you know, that it wasn't. So we talked about the idea of using it as a you know, on ramp, and that we would then like on ramp them in, and that got vetoed down, and as opposed to the idea of like just have this be its own thing. So once we got past that, it was like that was actually good. That was a good decision in many ways, because trying to on ramp to AD&D from basic expert would have required us to make a whole lot of different choices and, you know, compromises about stuff. Whereas now we got to make kind of like, okay, let's just make, you know, a kind of bare bones, simpler version of D&D, you know, a where we could focus on making sure it was playable, making sure it's, you know, fairly fast moving and quick, doesn't get, you know, and it turned into, it's a different flavor of D&D. You got AD&D for people who wanted a much more detail. They wanted the kind of the depth of all sorts of things. And then you wanted, you know, there was D&D for like, I want to go have an adventure.
Okay.
And, you know, play and have a good time, be quick, not get bogged down in a lot of, you know, particular detail, but still have enough in it that was like, this does not feel like I'm playing a dumbed down game or anything like that. And so yeah, it at that point it became its own thing. I actually, to the these days, prefer, when I'm running at conventions, I prefer to run D&D games as opposed to AD&D games, because,
interesting,
you know, I got 4 hours to get people to an adventure, right, and it's just faster, and I can, you know there's less for them to have to like try and learn, you know, and figure out and all that sort of stuff, and it goes quickly. So there was some talk about it, there was some discussion of it, but that was then, you know, like I said, that was then vetoed as to just make it, we're going to just make it its own product line. And right, that's why we committed then to both the basic and expert set. If we just wanted to do an on-ramp, we would have done basic and with a clear, and then now go buy the AD&D books and, you know, do all that sort of stuff. But it would have been a very different basic, because we did things that you know are completely incompatible in
right,
many ways with D&D. It's like, oh look, you know, we don't have class per se, we don't have race per se, we just have, you know, character. You can pick the, you know, if you are a fighter, you are a human automatically. That's
right. So one of the things that I've never really understood was why is the basic set about exploring dungeons, and then the expert set is supposed to be focused on like exploring the wilderness? Because it feels to me that you would be doing both.
Two things. One is because dungeons are the first iconic thing that comes to people's minds. I'm going to go into a dungeon and explore. They're also the simplest thing to set up, in that here is a town, here is a dungeon. I give you lots and lots of levels. We can have this go on forever. You know, I can,
right,
you know, be exploring the dungeon until I die, kind of a thing. And so there's that. then wilderness is kind of its whole separate thing, and it's got a whole, and the thing is, there's a whole bunch of rules we just got to get established, like you as a character, your abilities, these monsters, and here's a hole in the ground. And we had, 64 pages. So that pretty much takes all 64 pages just to cover that. And then when the experts said, it's like, okay, you know about you, your character, and all this sort of stuff. Now we're going to show how you advance. You can build. And now we're going to open up this other thing. Is here's this old big world. And how do you build this? How do you play in this kind of a space? Because it's not like a dungeon where I'm just going to go down this way and I'm going to turn left and then I get a choice of doors. It's not like, oh, I'm here and I can go 365 degrees any direction. How do you kind of build that kind of a world? How do you build adventures there? That sort of stuff. And so it was in many ways, it was a natural kind of like start them simple, start with them very focused kind mm-hmm. of a thing. Lots of entertainment value. And then now we get them up to, it's third level. You got up to third level, you hit. And now we say, oh, and now, this door opens kind of magically, as it were, to now there's this whole bigger world. And now you can have towns with other dungeons and all this sort of stuff that people can kind of now, expand and progress through. The other part of it was we figured that, for the first three levels, if we sent you into a wilderness, we'd have to make that wilderness so weak for you to survive that it wouldn't feel right later on. What do we do to you later on? Because we can't level ban. We didn't want to level ban the wilderness, right? So we wanted to kind of get everybody done the stuff in dungeons. Now you're ready to go explore the bigger world. And, at fourth level, you can still die horribly, but at least you have a chance.
So is the idea that the home base would be so close to the dungeon that the wilderness crawl wouldn't necessarily be important? Or was it more of a question of, we're just going to, you should just start at the front, at the door of the dungeon, and then
they pretty much almost start. I mean, if you look at the basic book, they pretty much almost started the door to the dungeon. There's a mention of you came from town and you go back to this town and buy supplies. And there's no mention of shops. There's no mention of townkeepers. You just go buy supplies, right? And you come back. And so it's like everything outside of the dungeon was kind of abstracted. And then when you go to expert, suddenly now that place that you were abstracting, now we're going to give it some life and stuff. And there are going to be people who tell you stories about this place that's 10 miles off that direction and all that sort of stuff. And now that very abstract town that you kind of started from becomes now a more real place, but it still serves as a hub for you to go off and do, go out and find other stuff and then move, gradually expand further out from there. Because, it's again, limited number of pages, teaching a whole, basically kind of explaining a whole new concept for gaming, especially early, especially mm-hmm. in the 80s, it was still a very new concept for gaming. And then, setting you up with, here is a place to go adventure that you can build and work with. And we're not going to make you worry about townskeepers and shopkeepers and mayors and all that stuff. You don't worry about any of that stuff. And then now, when you've done it for a while, now we'll add that extra bit to worry about.
Right, makes sense. Shifting a little bit from D&D, 1982, you helped design Star Frontiers. Are you more a fantasy dude? Sci-fi, or are you just you don't make the distinction, or there was no distinction really at that point about the two?
Well, in the 60s, 70s, when I grew up, basically, if your choices weren't I'm going to be a fantasy guy, I'm going to be a science fiction guy, your four choices are what's out there available. And frankly, in the 60s especially, it was science fiction. There was very little fantasy. Okay. And there wasn't a lot of fantasy. There was some, but and then in the 70s, fantasy writing starts to pick up and science fiction. And so, but you know, when you're looking for something to read, you want alternative fiction. In the 70s, you know, and even into the 80s, you weren't that picky. It's like you couldn't be that picky in some ways. If you wanted to read good stuff, you know, you kind of read both. You read science fiction and fantasy. Now, people have their preferences for which they liked better. And I like them both. I like fantasy in some ways because it's easier to tell a story in fantasy. It's easier to craft a story in fantasy. And for adventures, it's easier to create an adventure in fantasy. Science fiction I like because I like science, right? I liked hard science fiction and this sort of stuff. Wasn't that big on space opera because space operas look like fantasy. They look like fantasy gussied up in the future.
Right.
but they were clearly, you know, looked like they could be a lot of fun to play, this sort of stuff. So when we got presented with doing Star Frontiers, I was like, yeah, we need a science fiction title. It's a perfect natural. It's the natural thing to complement AD&D was to have a science fiction game. And Traveler had beat us out and had a science fiction game. And so we said, yeah, we gotta go in there and compete. And so that was the impetus to creating, you know, Star Frontiers instead. And was that, you know, we should be in this field. We should not be giving up this market.
Right.
We should, you know. And some of Lawrence and I, who are both like science fiction, you know, read all of the Golden Age, Silver Age stuff we could get our hands on, that sort of thing. Yeah, we were like, okay, we can do this. It's a role-playing game. We looked at Traveler, and we said, because they were guys who came out of a much more hard wargaming, board wargaming kind of thing, and a hard science kind of a thing. And the hard science part wasn't really the problem, but it was the hard wargaming, and that we felt that they just didn't understand role-playing is about story. And that they were not giving you really the material, the methods that they were giving them to you, but they weren't exploiting them themselves. And if you looked at Traveler and you got into it, you could make stories and you can make great adventures, but they weren't doing that. They were looking more at like the, all right, we're going to have, you know, space fleets. You know, okay, it's all about spaceships and all this sort of stuff. And it's like, you got to have guys on a planet and have them doing like dealing with weird things. That sort of stuff.
Can you expound a little bit on when you say that role playing is about a story? Like, when you say it, what do you mean by that? Because some people would argue that that's not what role playing is about.
I would be very puzzled. I am very puzzled to think what they think role playing is about, I think, at that point. Because role playing is, it's all about story as far as I'm concerned. Now, there's a lot of rules. I mean, yes, it can be very mechanistic or it can be very, very fast and loose. We've seen systems that run the gamut there, everything from diceless amber type system all the way over to like, you know, I've never been able to play most of the ones that are like desperately every inch of the game is a die roll kind of a thing. But it's ultimately about there has to be a story, because there has to be a story. There's got to be something that is the motivation for the character to go do this. Why am I going doing this? What is the goal? What is my purpose here? And the purpose, you know, it's like, go in the dungeon, get rich, get famous. Okay, I'm going to go in the dungeon, I'm going to get rich, get famous. And then they start to add their own, like, spin. They start to add their story to that. Well, now that I'm going to get rich and famous, I'm going to go into the tavern and see who will buy me free drinks or whatever. And it becomes, you know, and so it is impossible for me to imagine role-playing as not having very strong story elements. You know, story elements don't have to be me punch that guy or I, you know, rescued this person. It can be my legion of you know, Death Walkers, you know, conquered this territory. You know, it can be whatever. It's whatever the scale is. Now, mind you, I was a English major, theater minor, so I am always about story, but you know, most of the people at TSR at the time, whether we had guys who were, you know, mathematicians or, you know, astrophysicists, had been trained as astrophysicists and this sort of stuff. But it always came down to, you know, I need a good story for this adventure. This module I'm writing needs a good hook. And, you know, whether you believe in story or not, you know, you believe that I can't get anybody to pick it up off the shelf, but there's not like they can't look at the back of the cover and read the, oh, wow, this is what I get to do, and it sounds exciting, kind of a thing. So, yeah, and one of the great things that role playing did is that a lot of very good Hollywood writers and you know, showrunners and comedians, you know, cut their teeth as kids learning how to craft stories that would engage an audience by, you know, running role-playing games, because, you know, that's what it was all about. And now today we have people who are, you know, streaming their games because games are good stories done with, you know, people who have who have invested the effort and the skill to do it. You know, they make good stories and good entertainment.
Well, that's something I wanted to ask you about. Back in the day, obviously YouTube wasn't a thing, but did you ever imagine that at some point in the future, people would be watching other people play, like not participating, but just watching people playing these games? Like, that must have been mind-blowing to you the first time that you ever saw that.
Yeah, it still is kind of mind-blowing for me. I mean, basically, we never imagined it. It kind of really, and when it first kind of started cropping up, it was like, well, why would anybody do that? You know, it's like, that sounds like the most boring thing to do, watching other people play, right? And then, you know, they start investing, you know, they start investing both, you know, personal talent and basically, you know, production talent into it and stuff. And then it's like, oh, I'm watching now, you know, you'll notice comedians, you know, are very good at this sort of thing because it's improv. It is literally about how do we entertain an audience? How do we make them feel like, you know, it's in some ways it's kind of like we don't write plays, we play adventures. But it's essentially, it's kind of a little bit of the same sort of thing. By the time, we always thought, like, oh, why would I, you know, because, you know, you'd go to a convention and somebody would want to tell you about their adventure, right? Oh, I went, it was great. And then the next thing you know, it's like, oh, God, get me out of here.
Yeah, it is interesting.
It's because, frankly, the best adventures people have, they almost never translate into stories that are easy to tell, because, you know, all the things that made it great for them, they leave out in the telling of the events that happened.
I wanted to go back a little bit because it feels like, or at least from my understanding, that there was definitely some sort of a transition in terms of like how the game was played, let's say like pre-second edition, and then moving into second edition, it seemed like like with Dragonlance and that kind of stuff, that story came way more to the forefront, and almost to the point where like the books tied in with the adventures and all that. So was that always something that was there and was just brought out more, or was there like a definite drive to like bring the focus more to that kind of level of storytelling?
I'm not sure it was either. I think it was more a case of we didn't know what we were doing. Mm. Or we didn't, or actually more we didn't know what we could do. So initially, we knew how to like write adventures. You know, we had a set of rules. We knew how to write adventures, and so you'd write an adventure, and it just kind of existed as an adventure. And it was like, yeah, here's this dungeon outside of this, you know, in a swamp someplace, and you know. And then, you know, then you realize, like, oh, they want, you know, there's, well, where is that swamp in relation to this other adventure? And then you start saying, like, wait, we can make a bigger space. And so then we started, like, you know, kind of play, but, you know, that's, and Greyhawk was a lot of that, was kind of the first of that. But it was interesting because Greyhawk was that, but at the same time, it kept us from exploring it more, because everything that was going into Greyhawk had to be approved by Gary, because it was his world. But that meant that there were a lot of adventures, and so you'll see in the early D&D days, after Greyhawk Adventures is out, the first Greyhawk Adventures is out, is that there were a whole bunch of models that weren't really identified as to where they were, right? And because, you know, we had to put out, we had to schedules to meet, and they weren't necessarily approved, so they just kind of existed. And then we realized that, these things have more meaning if you can put them, or if we can take these adventures and put them into a bigger context of a campaign, kind of, right? That then we can not only have the adventures, but then we have the campaign, and we could sell the campaign. And mind you, we were trying to make money, right?
Right.
So, and that's where Forgotten Realms first shows up. And when there have been some small proto campaign kind of things in both in Basic and Expert, and also in Dragon Magazine, some people had kind of said, like, yeah, here's my world, and everybody had been doing campaigns for even since the beginning of original D&D. There was Blackhawk, Blackmoor, all this sort of stuff. But nobody was really like reaching in big and good. I think one of the first ones was probably Chaosium's was one of the first ones that really developed, like, here is a campaign setting and kind of a thing. So from that, then we said, okay, these campaign things, now we can actually, like, start tying things together. You got a campaign, you start getting lore passing back and forth between things. There's all sorts of things to keep track of and that sort of stuff. And then it was, kind of that led then into the, people like campaigns. People liked campaigns and campaign books in some ways more than they liked the adventures. We would sell more of the campaign books than we would sell the adventures. So then I was like, well, maybe we should do more campaigns. We went off and made too many of them. That was a problem. But that led to, okay, well, what makes this campaign different from that one? These are some, and then that leads into Dark Sun and Spelljammer and Planescape but the thing about, you mentioned Dragonlance, the thing about Dragonlance was the first one that really reached out and said, we are going to make a story that has a completely unique setting. Mm-hmm. This is not Forgotten Realms. This is not Greyhawk. This is its own little world, its own little camp world that has its own set of rules about in history. And so literally, we kind of discovered that whole building world stuff backwards, because we built it as a series of adventures. And then we said, oh, wait, we should put out a campaign setting for it.
So during your time, you worked on Conan the Barbarian and Indiana Jones.
Oh, yeah.
There was even Escape from a New York board game, which I had no idea that existed. What was, did you have any really cool experiences? Like, did you get to meet any of these people, like Arnold Schwarzenegger or?
No. I wish I could say I did. But the coolest, possibly the coolest, you know, of those, and it wasn't all that cool, was when we were working on the Escape from New York board game. You know, they sent us a script, and I think I had about 2 weeks to design a game.
Holy cow.
Yeah, so it's like, yeah, we need this right now.
That's incredible.
Well, that's why it's an awful lot like Clue.
That's too funny.
You know, you have to run and find all the pieces, you get all the right pieces, you get the answer, and yeah, you can go, you can win the game. And you know, they arranged a screening for us, for DSR employees, to see the Escape from New York movie before it was released. And so we all went up to Milwaukee and we got to see the movie. It was like, holy crap.
That's so cool.
Wow. Yeah, for us, this was a big thing. Like, wow, Hollywood, you know. With the Conan stuff and you know, it was just like, hey, you know, Conan licensed people. They were like, yeah, okay, we can do this. You know, we had to decide, like, well, what do we have license to? Because there were a lot of people who wrote for Conan. And, you know, you figure out, like, oh, no, we're only talking about the Howard material. And, you know, so, you know, we had to figure out where our limits existed. And then, you know, I basically spent a lot of time rereading Howard, pulling out every reference to every obscure person, place, or thing I could find. And then, you know, and take a bunch of the, you know, he had some maps, and we had some of that stuff available. We had the comic books. We were able to use the comic books too. Yeah. And so we had that material, and then you mine out every bit of detail you can. And then, you know, you design a system that feels like it will fit with it. And you know, Conan game's still fun to play. It's very different from in like setup from D&D and stuff, but at its heart, it's a role-playing game.
When you worked on a licensed property like that during that time period, would like the people who owned, like for instance, the Conan, would they give you guys material? Like they would be like, okay, here's a pile of books and stuff you can take, or was it more?
They would send you know, the Conan people. They sent us copies of the books that had been, you know, which we had all read already, but you know, it was good to have on hand. With the Indiana Jones, with the Indiana Jones people, so we were working on that before the second movie was released. So, and our license was very strict, in that we could use what was in the first and second movie, which hadn't been released yet, so we didn't know what was in the second movie, and we could use what was in the comic books, but we could not. We were very restricted about what we could then create. We were not allowed to create like new characters or stuff. That was actually a problem at the time. And this was when LucasArts was their first foray into role playing games. And I am sad and happy to say that they learned from their mistake and gave the Star Wars people much more freedom. Which I wish we would have had.
Right. I guess that would have been West End Games when they got there.
Yeah. West End Games, yeah. And literally, to find out what was going on in the second movie, they flew, myself and Tracy Hickman had to fly to, because Tracy was going to write the module, the Temple of Doom module. And you know, I was doing the game. They flew us to Marin County, out to San Francisco, and up to Marin County, to where their licensing offices were, literally put us in a conference room with a copy of the script, and I don't know as we were allowed to take notes.
Oh my gosh.
We could read it and they literally kind of like almost locked us in this room with the script. We were not allowed, we were definitely not allowed to take a copy of the script. I think we were allowed to make notes.
Wow, that's intense.
But the secrecy level was insane, right? And we had like 2 days, and we had a day to read through it, and I think another day that we could come back and do it. But we had 2 days to go through all this and, you know, get everything we could out. There was no footage, there was nothing, just the script. And then we, you know, go back and, you know, figure out and put it into the game. And it was like, that fortunately, the Lucas people got much better, and which was, you know, why Star Wars, you know, in part, I'm sure a good reason why Star Wars has succeeded well is they let the role-playing people do what role-playing people do, which is make stuff up.
What kind of a relationship did you have with the people at West End Games? Like,
we hired a few of them later on.
Okay. But because I'm not really familiar with West End Games in terms of like where they were situated.
Oh, West End was way out in Pennsylvania. Way over, and we were in like, and you know, this is all pre-internet days, and so unless you knew somebody over there, you could call up, or you know, you knew somebody in another company, you really didn't know much of what other people were up to, except for what was press released or you know rumors and that sort of stuff, and you know, and also we were extremely busy, and we would just kind of focus on stuff, so when you'd see everybody at conventions, right? And at, you know, you'd try to make new friendships at conventions, and a lot of it was you'd trade products, so everybody could kind of like, you know, ooh, I want a copy of Ghostbusters and Star Wars and all this stuff. I'll give you, you know, I can give you this sort of stuff, you know, and a lot of horse trading going on. And you'd go back and you'd like, you know, you'd read what you were interested in, and maybe give some of it away or just stick it on a shelf and never look at it again.
When you worked on Oriental Adventures, now today when you go on to like drive through RPG to buy
a warning on it.
Yeah, they have, right? They're like, these aren't reflective of our current beliefs and blah 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 and whatever. So I kind of feel like obviously when you went into writing this, you didn't go like, I'm going to be disrespectful of the like cultures and whatnot.
I was trying not to be, but you know, it was a challenge, you know. And how do I feel about this now? It's a different time. It's a different mindset with people. And I could rant and rave about how, you know, in my day, you know, it's like, no, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. Would it be something, if somebody had came to you today and was kind of like, hey, would you be interested in working on a property or not a property, but on a subject matter like this, would you be like, yeah, no, I'm not interested in doing, like, I don't feel like I'm culturally sensitive enough now to, or like, it must be tough.
No, I'm stupid. If it was a subject area I'm interested in, I'd say yes.
Yeah.
I would try to get more advice and input than, I mean, in truth, when Oriental Adventures happened, there were not a lot of, you know, Asians that I knew, that we knew, that were actually even doing anything role playing, and there were a few. But you know, but at the same time, I had three months to get this done.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, and so there really, really was not a lot of time to. And now we will like send this out for review and comment and revision and all this stuff. No, this was like it had to be on, it had to be done, so it get on the shelves. I had a great interest in Oriental, which frankly at the time mostly meant Japanese,
right?
Because you know, if you want to go back to the dark old days of the 70s, there was not a lot of material published about Chinese, especially Chinese, you know, fantasy and mythological culture. It was very hard to find. It was hard enough to find Japanese stuff, but you know, I tried to find as much as I could, processed it. You know, some of it did get, we did have some Japanese gamers who were able to kind of do a review of the manuscript and give some feedback and stuff, and which was helpful. But yeah, this was, again, pre-internet days. It was very hard to, and at this point, China was still, while opened in 70-something, was still pretty closed society. And we're living in Wisconsin, which is like not exactly the hotbed of, like, you know, I couldn't go to, you know, San Francisco Chinatown or anything like that.
Right.
And even, you know, that was not really an option. So you did the best you could, did my best to try and be respectful of stuff that I understood. There is a whole lot of crap, I'm sure there's a whole lot I'm sure I didn't understand. I am still making discoveries to this day of things I don't understand about other cultures. And I love it. I love making new discoveries.
For sure.
So I am not going to sit here and complain about the fact that there's a warning on it. It's a little weird, but I'm not going to, you know. I am perfectly happy if, they feel that it needs to be revised, you know, they felt it needed to be redone and stuff. That's on them. That's fine. It doesn't kill me. What hurts is that people think that I was in any way intentionally trying to do something
right
horrible, which is no, I was not trying to do that.
Right. It's been so great to talk to you and hear your perspective and just to, you know, be talking to the person who has like created such fantastic, modules and, you know, left such a legacy in the hobby. And you're such a humble guy. I feel like I could.
Well, I got an ego, trust me.
But I could listen to you talk about all this stuff forever. So maybe we'll have to do a part two or something. But,
sure. Yeah.
But, I just wanted to thank you again for coming on. Did you have anything like, something that you wanted to plug or a way for people to get in touch with you or just everybody leave me alone?
I am currently cheerfully retired and not quite bored enough yet to take on any big projects. So I don't have anything of mine to plug, but I will plug Bill's game that I have been playing in, his Necromancer game. I've been helping him play test that now for a year and a half. And it is very much goes back to really the old school, almost of original D&D kind of thing, where it's like, oh, look, in five adventures, I might gain a level if I'm lucky. a lot more of it is left to role playing and wits than like I have 18 abilities that I can do things with, you know. So I've been playing my little wizard, cheerfully blowing things up because I now have a fireball.
Nice. That's awesome.
I will plug his game.
All right. I'll make sure to put that in the link. I did back it. And I guess whenever, I don't know if there's like a thing for late backers, but I'll try to figure it out.
I'm sure Bill will figure out some way that he can sell it to people who want it.
100%. So, all right. Well,
all right.
Thanks very much, Zeb. And to the rest of you, plungers up.
Ooh, that sounds ominous.
That's all for this week, folks. Music and stingers by Reed Reimer of Fable Factory Studio. Cover art by John McNally. And a special thanks to Edward Vallee, the voice of Hector.
Greetings, listener. This is I, Hector, the real Dungeon Plunger. Not that milk drinker Jason. We in the dungeon always appreciate whatever love you can give us. So please, share the podcast, send your messages, and do anything that will unclog our algorithm. We really appreciate it. Plungers up!
And remember, when you're plunging in the dungeon and nature calls, watch out for mimics disguised as toilets. They're a pain in the butt.